from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
After months of shutdowns, capacity restrictions, and virtual-only performances, theaters, concert halls, museums, art galleries, and other venues are again throwing open their doors to the public. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we'll gather some arts and culture organization leaders to discuss their post-pandemic plans and how they've weathered the economic downturn and other impacts of the pandemic. We'll talk about recent leadership turnover in some local organizations and how institutions plan to improve and maintain equity in the arts. We want to hear from you, too. Call us with your questions and your thoughts as we discuss and celebrate the reemergence of the arts this hour on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Good to have you with us today as we explore the reemerging arts here in Louisville and everywhere. As we finally start to breathe that sigh of relief that we appear to be getting the upper hand on the coronavirus, although there's still some road to travel, we thought this would be a good time to check the health of the arts and our arts and culture institutions. They've all had their struggles, of course, with the economic slide caused by COVID. Effective today in Kentucky, most of Governor Andy Beshear's coronavirus restrictions are being lifted, including capacity limits, and we'll see where we're going. We'll also talk about leadership in the arts and equity in the arts and arts institutions. We have a lot of guests to guide us this hour. Let's start with introducing our own Stephanie Wolf, WFPL Arts Reporter. Stephanie, good to have you here. Good to have you here in person.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In a moment, we'll bring in Andy Trinan, president and CEO of the Fraser History Museum here in Louisville, which has some big plans for this summer and beyond. And later, we'll meet Andre Kimo Stone Guest, the incoming director of the Fund for the Arts, the regional arts agency and the largest funder of arts in the greater Louisville region. Liam Sweeney will be with us later, senior analyst whose research focuses on museums and cultural organizations at Ithaca S&R. We'll hear more about that. Later, we'll hear more about equity in the arts with Marlisha Woods, owner of L's and O's Storytelling Gallery, and Brianna Harlan will join us later, who is an artist and organizer. And of course, we want to hear from you, too. How do you plan to enjoy and reacquaint yourself with Louisville's and Kentucky's and the region's arts and culture events and institutions? What do you want to see them do as we go forward? We're going to be talking about equity in the arts this hour as well. And what's your assessment of that as we stand now? And what steps should be taken to improve equity? Call us with your thoughts, 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet if you like. Our handle is WFPL News, and we're also on Facebook. So, Stephanie, let's start with you. You've been out in the arts community talking with people. You keep an eye on what's happening nationally. And how are things looking in general in terms of a pandemic recovery from your viewpoint, from your perspective? And is there a renewed sense of optimism at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a renewed sense of optimism in part because there are many organizations that for the first time in more than a year are able to hold in-person events. Not that there haven't been in-person arts events happening in the past, you know, year plus. Those have been happening with capacity limits and stuff like that. But this is a much broader return. I think a lot of arts groups are still hurting, though. Many, you know, have applied for federal aid through the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Program, and that has been a real rocky road these past nearly 6 months. And, you know, they've only awarded 90 of those grants, and that's across the country total. So one in Kentucky.
Why has that been so slow to materialize?
There's been a couple of things. It took a while to sort of figure out how to implement it, to get everything in place. So the portal opened in early April, and as quickly as it opened, it crashed. The website was down for weeks. And then as it did reopen and people were applying, they were coming across different sorts of technical difficulties and clerical errors. And a number of groups have said they haven't had ways to resolve the problems with their paperwork to get that funding. So they're still, from my understanding, they're still doing the sort of first priority funding round. So those in the most dire need were supposed to get that money first. So those 90 grants that have been awarded are for those who have lost 90% or more of their revenue due to the pandemic.
We'll talk more about that, and we'll talk more with Stephanie in general about the arts and culture here in Louisville and beyond. But I want to bring in Andy Trinan, who was president and CEO of the Fraser History Museum. Andy, thanks for waiting. Good to have you with us.
Absolutely, Rick. Stephanie, great to be in conversation with you this afternoon.
Yeah, same.
For those who don't know, we do have listeners joining us outside of the Louisville area. The Fraser History Museum has evolved since it was founded as a historical arms museum, I believe, somewhat 17 years ago. Give us a little bit of an overview of what visitors experience there and what you offer at the museum.
Absolutely, and thanks for the opportunity, Rick. Our brand is where the world meets Kentucky. We have taken on this position as an attraction that is a starting point for tourism in the state of Kentucky. And that means a couple of different things. Number one, we're the official starting point of the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. So we've got this multi-million dollar bourbon experience, the Spirit of Kentucky Bourbon exhibit that is about the category of bourbon. The distilleries do an amazing job of teaching you how to make bourbon and talking about their brands. But why is this something that is a Kentucky product? 95% of the bourbon in the world is made in the state of Kentucky. 100% of the good bourbon in the world is made in the state of Kentucky. So why did that happen? And we tell those stories. We talk about the water. We talk about the limestone. We talk about the rich, rich history that has distillers coming here. And we also have the Kentucky Bourbon Trail Welcome Center. So we're essentially a concierge for bourbon tourists who are coming to the state. And they have a certain budget. They have a certain amount of time. They want to end their day in a certain part of the state, we help them to guide their trips. And then this last year, we also opened Cool Kentucky, which has artifacts and display items from essentially every museum in the state. So when you walk in, you see a Corvette. And if you're interested in the Corvette, it inspires you to go to Bowling Green to the Corvette Museum. If it's bluegrass music you're interested in, you may want to go to Owensboro. We have George Clooney's overalls and boots that he wore in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And, you know, that may inspire you to go to the Rosemary Clooney Museum. So it is an It Starts Here experience for tourists in Kentucky. And I tell people all the time, if you haven't been to the Fraser in the last 2 years, you haven't been to the Fraser. Mr. Fraser did an amazing job in first-class facility here when this was a historic arms museum. But we're a different-looking place with a different entrance and a different experience inside.
Well, you weathered the pandemic, as have other institutions. I was looking through some of the recent projects and initiatives at the Fraser, and we all quickly learned that you just couldn't wait for the pandemic to blow over. You had to work within it, restrictions and all, and the Fraser was no exception. Tell us how you adjusted over the past 15 months, and then we'll talk about the future.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, absolutely. I heard Stephanie talking about the Shuttered Venues Grant. We are one of those institutions that is waiting to hear on that. We have filed for that. We also filed for PPP funding, and we're lucky enough to get that to survive the last year. But essentially, you know, this is a 100,000 square foot facility that lost its parking, museum store revenue, facility rental revenue, camps and field trip revenue, admission revenue, and we do over 200 events a year. So we, you know, we had to kind of figure out how we were going to survive that. I'm proud to say our staff has done an incredible job of weathering the storm, and it's, you know, we've got 150 kids downstairs right now. We had over 1,000 people in last week. There is a real hunger for people to get out and have human interaction, so we're excited to be on the back end of that. But one of the things we did initially was we had to create our experience virtually, so we developed what is the Virtual Fraser Magazine, which was being delivered every day. It's now once a week. And it basically tells the stories that we tell inside here. We had to deliver it free to the public, and the hope there, Rick, was that we expand our brand and we mean more to more people. And I'm happy to say that that has worked. That is now delivered to 40,000 people every Monday morning. We don't reach 40,000 people in person in a week's time, so we are speaking to more people. Part of the reason that number has grown so much, the people who subscribe to that magazine, is we also launched a free membership for people who live in the 12-county region surrounding Louisville, because we wanted to inspire people to come back downtown, and we wanted to get into different audiences that haven't traditionally seen themselves in history museums by making it free for them to come here, but also making sure that when they came, they saw themselves inside. Because if you see stories about yourself and the people you relate to, you're more inclined to want to come back and, you know, maybe sign up for membership when that comes with a cost again and make this an important part of your and your family's life.
Well, you made a big announcement this week, I believe it was this week, about some plans you have for this summer. You mentioned the great distilling and bourbon tradition we have here in the area, but we also have a great tradition of brewing beer, which continues to this day, and you're going to celebrate that, right?
Yeah, this is a big one, and this is a big undertaking, Rick. We announced on Wednesday the first ever summer beer festival at the Fraser, and it'll be outside, and our parking lot will be shaped into the Fraser Beer Garden. We hope to draw thousands and thousands of people down here. We'll have some great live music. We'll have over 200 beers available for tasting. You pay for your ticket and you get to come in and taste up to 40 different beers with that admission, just 2-ounce tastings. And it's really a great initiative. We're excited about our team's working really hard on it. We actually found that the first building that beer was distributed out of post-prohibition was 829 West Main Street, the building that we reside in right now. It was Budweiser Beer, and here's the real irony, it was August 7th of 1934. So the festival will be on August 7th of 2001, 67 years after beer was first distributed out of the building that we reside in now.
We've got about a minute left, but I know this has been, of course, a season of racial reckoning here in Louisville, especially, but around the world. And I know you've been cognizant of that at the Fraser as well. I was looking through some of your upcoming events, and tell us a little bit in the seconds we have left about West of Ninth coming up in September.
Absolutely. West of Ninth was originally, there are a couple of bloggers, Shay and Walt Smith, who they were in Nulu, and they were looking at T-shirts celebrating the great neighborhoods in Louisville, and they noticed that none of the great neighborhoods west of Ninth Street were listed on that T-shirt. So they took it upon themselves to create a blog and start going into those neighborhoods and just interviewing people and taking photographs. We saw this as inspiration to create an exhibit around it. It was going to open last year, and then we had all of the challenges that we had with the Breonna Taylor killing and all the things that followed, and we decided we were going to hold off on debuting that last year. It is going to debut in September of this year, and it's going to include all the other issues around West of Ninth. Yes, it will be a celebration of those people and the great history, but it will also detail redlining and some of the things that have happened in that community, busing, many of the other issues, policing, that have had an impact. So we're excited about that. We're excited about our Unfiltered Truth and our Unknown Project also that touch on diversity, equity, and inclusion as well.
All right, got to stop you there. Andy Trinan with the Fraser History Museum. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Great pleasure, Rick. Thank you.
We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. And today we're talking about arts and culture, how organizations are faring, and what the future holds. We have WFPL arts reporter Stephanie Wolf with us, who's going to be with us throughout the rest of the program and also conversing with our guest. And joining us this segment is Andre Kimo Stone Guest, incoming president and CEO of the Fund for the Arts, which serves the Louisville region and funds numerous arts programs. Among many other roles, he has served as CEO of the August Wilson Center for African American Culture in Pittsburgh, as vice president and producer for jazz at Lincoln Center in New York, and as vice president of the Lincoln Foundation Incorporated in Louisville. He is a Louisville native, grew up in Smoketown. Andre, welcome to the program. Good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Liam Sweeney is a senior analyst with the Library Scholarly Communication and Museums Program at Ithaca SNR, where he researches issues of organizational structure, leadership, and public access as the cultural cultural sector. Excuse me. And I think Michelle is working to get Liam on the line. Liam, are you there?
Hear me?
I hear you. Are you there? Can you hear me?
You're very faint.
Okay.
We'll see your end.
We'll see if we can get that fixed up, and we'll start talking with Andre. First of all, congratulations, Andre. I know you begin with the Fund for the Arts in June. Tell us what's on your mind now, what your expectations are as you begin the new job.
Well, yeah, I take over for Kristen Boone on July 1st at the beginning of our next fiscal year, and now I'm just taking in as much information as I can. My ears are wide open, you know, to sort of understand what's going on in the city. We're opening back up. It's an interesting time to be a part of this community. So I'm just really trying to learn all that I can as I get prepared to take over.
WFPL Arts reporter Stephanie Wolf is here. I think you're familiar with her, and she had a question as well. Go ahead, Stephanie.
I mean, yeah, we were just talking about the pandemic's impact on the arts, particularly financially, that's been significant. So I do wonder what part you see yourself playing in helping the arts recover from the pandemic, and if you have any sense of what you think might need to happen first there.
Well, like I said, I'm listening right now and trying to meeting with all the arts organizations. I'm meeting with all the key stakeholders to really take an inventory of what their sense of the overall ecosystem is and what their specific needs and challenges are. And once I've had all those conversations, I will put all that information up on a big board somewhere and try to synthesize it into something that will then give me a sense of how sort of where we need to go and where the priorities might be. The pandemic was a Darwinian event. Some people will not come out of it as an organization, and some individual artists were impacted to the point where they may not necessarily practice their art as a profession anymore. So, and things have changed forever, and not only in the arts, but in business in general. So there's going to be some hybrid of the way that we functioned last year and where we find ourselves now. So it's a matter of trying to find out what that new normal is going to be and try to create a glad path to there from where we are now.
Yeah, so the stakeholders in the Louisville arts scene unveiled this master cultural plan back in April. And during that presentation, well-known arts administrator Michael Kaiser, who had a hand in sort of guiding through this process of creating the plan, he spoke to a noticeable inequity within the scene when it comes to funding and opportunities. In particular, he said there should be more investments to match the high quality of the city's Black artist and Black-led arts organizations. And I know you're new to this role and, you know, you're coming back to Louisville, but I do wonder if you have any thoughts to share on how you intend to approach that.
Well, I look at equity, a commitment to equity in the arts as an investment in equality for human beings. And what do I mean by that? Is that in how we approach equity in things like all of the different disparities, whether it be economic or educational or health disparities, those things will go a long way towards moving people from the position that they find themselves in, particularly African Americans, to in quality of life issues. But you could live in the biggest house and have all the education in the world and be a billionaire, but that doesn't necessarily affect how someone who's not like you will view you, or whether they view you as someone as equal. And in order for kings dream to come into focus, which is to judge people by the content of their character. I think there's really two large levers that we can sort of pull to get to that aspect of it. One of them is spirituality, not necessarily religion. It's a spiritual understanding of who you are in relation to your understanding of the Creator and your fellow human being. But the other one is the arts, because the one thing that the arts does, is arts and culture do, is that it actually reduces us away from our tribal leanings and our differences into Homo sapiens, into human beings, while elevating us into humanity. And that, from that standpoint, as we find ourselves in the city now, we must invest, we must commit to equity as it relates to particularly African-American artists to be able to heal a lot of the divide that's going on in the country in general, but specifically where we find ourselves now with a national and international spotlight on us because mm-hmm. of the Breonna Taylor.
Well, sort of going on the issue of equity as well, the fund has historically supported arts organizations, though last year it did provide grant opportunities to individual artists, which, you know, are a very important part of the local mm-hmm. ecosystem. How do you see that balance of support for institutions versus individuals?
Well, I don't know that I can speak to a specific balance, but I will say to you that part of my business last year and for the past 12 years, actually, was my wife and I in Guestworks, we managed the careers of world-class artists. Christian McBride, Nicholas Payton was a client at one time, Aaron Deal. So we understand the importance of the individual artist in the overall ecosystem. So that is definitely a priority, and we will find a way to continue to do that.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett, joined by WFPL arts supporter, arts reporter, and a supporter too, Stephanie Wolf, who is with us. And we're talking with Andre Kimo Stone Guest, incoming president of the Fund for the Arts based here in Louisville. We'll talk with him a little bit more, but I want to bring in Liam Sweeney, who is a senior analyst who is research focuses on museums and cultural organizations. And Liam is with Ithaca S&R, a nonprofit research firm. And let me start, because we're getting a broader national perspective now with Liam. Tell us about Ithaca, Liam, before we start, and what you do there.
Hi, Rick. Yeah, thanks so much for bringing me on the show. Yeah, Ithaca S&R is a nonprofit research firm. We do a lot of grant-funded research projects and some consulting work. And a lot of my work is focused on issues of equity, diversity, and inclusion in the cultural sector, focusing on issues from staff demographics in the field nationally to strategic directions and leadership perspectives in the field, with a survey of museum directors that we conducted just before the pandemic, actually.
Well, tell us what your research has found, especially in terms of equity and in terms of leadership at these institutions.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've conducted the staff demographic survey twice now. I believe we're going to have another cycle coming up, and we found that there was some gains made between 2015 and 2018, especially in education departments and curatorial departments. But it was interesting. We found there was really not a lot of progress made in senior administration positions and leadership positions over those 3 years. And so that was disheartening. And I think it shows that we have a lot of progress that still needs to be made at the higher end of management in cultural organizations.
Here in the Louisville area, we've had a lot of turnover, just generally speaking, in leadership at various organizations, either through moving on to other positions or retirements. The Speed Art Museum, the Muhammad Ali Center, Kentucky Museum of Art and Craft, KMAC, even the Louisville Zoo, the director there is retiring. Are you seeing a lot of turnover, Liam, in the organizations that you track throughout the country, or is this something that's just happening here in Louisville?
You know, I don't have hard numbers on this just yet. I think I will down the road a little bit, but I anecdotally am hearing about a lot of turnover and a lot of just challenges that leaders in the cultural sector are facing. You know, this has been a really difficult year, and I think a lot of leaders are faced with some really tough choices. And so I think that there has been some change there.
If you want to join our conversation about the arts here in Louisville and Kentucky and our region and beyond, call us at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet if you like. WFPL News is our handle. And we're also on Facebook. Stephanie, do you have another question for?
Yeah, I'd actually love to ask a question of Liam. We've talked in the past, and as part of your research, we discussed some of the case studies that you've done. And I actually wonder if you could talk a bit about the Brooklyn Museum in particular, when we're talking about arts organizations, arts nonprofits, as, you know, parts of the community. Can you share what you learned in looking at that museum specifically and some of the changes that they made there?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, the Brooklyn Museum is a really interesting case of a museum that did a hard pivot to focus more directly on its community back in the late 90s. The museum actually used to, its strategy for its audience was, but prior to that, was to bus its audience from the Met down to the Brooklyn Museum, and that was its strategy for audience engagement. The new director who came in there, Arnold Demon, he pivoted toward focusing more on the surrounding neighborhoods and did so with a program called First Saturdays, which has become kind of a famous party in Brooklyn. First Saturday of each month, the museum hosts a suite of programs, lots of music, lots of kind of dance and different forms of engagement. And, you know, it reached a point where the fire department would be regularly called in to set it down because it would reach, you know, thousands and thousands of people at the museum. So that's been wildly successful. But I think the Brooklyn Museum has gone further than that. They've actually started to do some really deep civic engagement with local stakeholders. They've established now a program called Project with the Center for Court Innovation here in New York, called Project Reset. It's a diversion program, and it helps to divert folks who've received court summons for nonviolent misdemeanors away from the arraignment process and into an arts program where they do, you know, 2 hours of arts engagement at the museum, and they're able to avoid the court system entirely. So I've been really encouraged by that, seeing that kind of activity at the museum, and, you know, seeing the museum sort of get proximate, to use Brian Stevenson's term, to its community and see where it can be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say, too, like in doing some of reporting about the leadership turnover, you know, Rick mentioned how many different institutions are experiencing that right now. And I have had some people, I guess, sort of question why there was curiosity around that or trying to link it. And I think what's fascinating to me is just this idea of it, you know, whether or not this is a big deal when major institutions are philanthropic groups have leadership turnover. And I just wonder, to Liam or Andre, if you want to weigh on this, if you've given any thought to what, you know, how big of a deal this is when there is a lot of leadership turnover in one cultural scene and what kind of ripple effect that can actually have.
Let's, well, Andre, I'll let you answer that. We haven't posed that question to you yet. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the one good thing about where we find ourselves in Louisville is that there's an overall cultural plan for the city. So to the extent that you have leadership change, at least you have a guiding force in terms of what the city itself has identified as the priorities. I don't necessarily see a problem with leadership change. It gives you an opportunity to sort of reassess and look at where you are. We're in a situation right now where there was going to be change to begin with because of COVID and the pandemic. So as you know, if you're going to have a change, you might as well have change all at once. So I'm a person that I'm not change for change sake, but I look at change as an opportunity to address the changing world, because the world has changed so much in the last 18 months. It's been sort of exponential in some regards. So embrace it and look at it and look at the larger landscape in terms of the priorities that have been set and walk into that, and you have a guiding force to actually move the ecosystem forward.
Liam, do you want to weigh in at all?
Yeah, thanks. I think that's absolutely right. And I also think it's a really important moment for the boards of these institutions to take a really close look at what the communities of these institutions serve, what they need, what has been lacking, and approach the process of recruiting and identifying some, you know, new directors of these institutions from that perspective, and considering, you know, what changes need to occur in the region.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We're having a discussion about the arts and culture and institutions and leadership here in our region, the Louisville area, Kentucky, and around the country. Andre Kimo Stone Guest is with us. He's the incoming president of the Fund for the Arts. And Liam Sweeney is with us, senior analyst with Ithaca SNR. It's a nonprofit research firm. Stephanie Wolf, WFPL arts reporter, is with us. And we have about another minute, Stephanie, or a minute and a half, if you want to pose a final question.
Yeah, this is for Andre. I mean, I'd love to hear how you think having roots in Louisville will help guide you in this role.
Well, I'm from the historic Smoketown neighborhood, a proud Smoketownian, and I think that if you want to sort of bring a whole community together, having been the CEO of the August Wilson Center in Pittsburgh, it was difficult for me to do that because I wasn't from there. And it made me really value looking at this opportunity, because I'm from the city. I have roots in the city. I have friends. I have family. And my family goes back over 120 years in the Smoketown community. So, and I have a passion and a love for my city. So this is not a job for me. This is an opportunity and really a responsibility. I'm standing on the shoulders of my grandparents and what they did in Smoketown, and I can't mess this up.
All right. We're just about out of time. I think we'll pause for our break here. I want to thank Andre Kimo Stone Guest, incoming president of the Fund for the Arts. And Andre, you start July 1st, right?
That's correct.
And Liam Sweeney, thank you for joining us with your perspective, senior analyst who's a research focuses on museums and cultural organizations at Ithaca SNR, a nonprofit research firm at WFPL. Stephanie Wolf is with us as well. Thanks, Stephanie, for your help. And we're not done yet. We have another segment coming up. We're going to talk about equity in the arts and in arts institutions with two guests that will be joining us. And we welcome your calls, 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet. WFPL News is our handle. And we're also on Facebook. Thanks again to our guest. We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
It doesn't matter how many LeBron Jameses you have, or Jesse Normans, or even Barack Obamas. Those accomplishments are considered consciously and subconsciously as anomalies. So, we have a lot of work to do in terms of recognizing admitting to our caste system and figuring out intentionally how to break it up.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville, and that piece of audio was gathered by WFPL arts reporter Stephanie Wolf, who is with us as we're talking about the arts here in Louisville and beyond, and our institutions and organizations as they reopen from the pandemic, and also a close look at racial equity in the arts. Tell us, give us some details about that audio, Stephanie.
Yeah, so that was from a rehearsal that I went to yesterday from a new one-act opera, which, first of all, what a thrill to see art in person. It's been a while for me, and to actually be, you know, hearing those singers in person. And the opera is about the life of civil rights and voting rights leader Fannie Lou Hamer. So this is a commission by the Santa Fe Opera, co-presented with Kentucky Opera. And the clip that you heard was Diana Solomon Glover. She wrote the libretto, which is the opera's text, the words that are sung. And she's been working on this opera for years now. And so I had asked her how the experience changed her as an artist. And she reflected on how, while the events depicted in the opera are largely from the 1960s, that these issues continue to be issues. And she's just, you know, she's sad and frustrated that more progress hasn't been made.
Well, we're going to talk about that in our final segment here on In Conversation. And let's bring in our two guests for this segment. Marlisha Woods is owner of Elles and Old Storytelling Gallery. She is a Louisville native, dedicated visual arts educator, and active professional member of the National Art Education Association, Teaching Artists Guild, and National Guild for Community Arts Education, as well as an interdisciplinary artist. She creates works that are translated into eco-friendly wearable art and creates exclusive designs for the Muhammad Ali Center here in Louisville. Marlisha, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate being here. Thank you for the invite.
Welcome to Brianna Harlan, who is a multi-form artist and organizer. She works in community intervention and recontextualized objects to innovate on how socio-political identity affects health, selfhood, and community. She's been published in several forums as an expert in cultural activism. Her equity and arts initiatives have been featured nationally in Art News. In 2020, she collaborated with Fourth Wall to create a monument for Breonna Taylor and had a New York solo exhibition, Black Love Blooms, New York Nook, to interrupt harmful narratives around Black public image and connection. Breonna, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
So let me start. I have to ask the typical pandemic question for our arts creators and arts organizations. Marlisha, how has the pandemic been for you? How have you emerged from it? What's your hope for the future?
Well, definitely, like everyone else, hopefully we were able to pivot and to find new ways to connect with individuals and organizations. I have been blessed enough to continue to collaborate and create this entire time and somewhat expand. So I just changed some practices, but definitely I was blessed never to have to close up shop. I look forward to seeing people in person in the near future. And in the meantime, virtually, I've been hanging out with a lot of folks.
How about you, Brianna? How have you been doing? And I'm sure you're optimistic for the future as we emerge from this pandemic. How's it going?
I don't know if I'm optimistic. I'd say that I'm realistic and hopeful. But I've been taking this time mostly to do a lot of training with other people who do this work and try to be in community with being both as like a student and someone that can maybe help facilitate spaces where other people can learn as well, so that when we come out of having to do everything virtually, people have are more supported in being able to do the things that they want to do and start the type of projects that they want to start based on where they see needs in this like highly concentrated time of struggle.
Well, let's talk about that. You said you're not quite ready to be optimistic yet, but you're all hopeful. Tell us about that. Tell us what your plans are here in the near future in terms of equity.
Okay. Yeah. So, So I'm part of a diversity, equity, and inclusion incubator in New York, and I'm getting a lot of training through that, through international leaders. And so I guess I'm kind of giving away something that I haven't really spoke about before, but I actually have a long-term plan to form a collective that will hopefully be based here in Louisville that basically levels the power dynamics in the work that the collective does, levels the power dynamics in a way that I haven't seen happen here yet. And through the collective's work, hopefully form networks the same way that I'm doing in this kind of incubator for diversity in New York, form networks that build out and build out and build out and continue to level and level and level until the city gets to see a new way of working. Now, I say that I haven't talked about that yet because when I say that's long term, I'm in no way ready or to do that. I have a lot of learning to do yet, but definitely I can't say that I'm optimistic because like the writer in the opera, there's not enough has happened. And so I don't have the gall to think that I'm going to be the one to be able to see it happen in my lifetime, but I'm definitely hopeful that the work that we do will matter.
WFP Arts reporter Stephanie Wolf is here with us. I know, Stephanie, you have some questions as well.
Yeah, I actually, Brianna, you and I have spoken in the past about some...
Hello.
Hi, it's good to hear from you. About the work that you had been doing here in Louisville. And so last summer you did a survey, actually, the Louisville Art Scene Report, and you were talking about plans to have conversations with local institutions about equity. And I'm just curious where you are in your work with that.
Yeah, so the open letter to the city came out in October. And now I am planning on releasing, hopefully in the fall, maybe before, kind of a like 1 year later, 1.5 year later report on as a follow-up. Because a lot of times these initiatives happen, but then there's no follow-up. So like the report will have a more detailed look at like what actually came out of the collection of data and qualitative data. And then it'll look at the institutions that had plenty of time to make changes since then and see if what they actually did.
Let's turn to you, Marlisha. What does equity in the arts look like to you? And who doesn't have a seat at the table? And how's it being addressed right now? Or how could it better be addressed in your view?
Well, when we view the art industry, we can ask and inquire what type of system are we addressing, right? So when we say art industry, what is that really? And in many cases in Louisville, Kentucky, we're talking about nonprofit organizations. And some of those organizations are participating in the nonprofit industrial complex and all of those, you know, issues that come with being a part of that industrial complex. So that is what we need to be addressing, not just, you know, using the loose terms of it's art and it's creative and it's free. No, let's name it, right? Because if we can name what the problem is, then we can address the problem. So really looking at it and seeing, okay, who's part of this nonprofit industrial complex, which in many cases breeds predatory practices, manufactures scarcity, right? You stifle the artist, you disrupt real true social change and sustainable growth by giving Band-Aid in many cases or reacting quickly to something and not really giving a solution. Arts organizations are a part of that. Many entities are a part of that, and artists not excluded. So when we think about equity, we need to start with what is a system, and if we can find the system, then we can figure out a way to either dismantle that system or remove ourselves from that system and create something new.
Well, I like that Brianna said that she has a long-term project coming up because, as you mentioned, Marlisha, there is this issue of reaction as opposed to making, you know, firm concrete plans for the long term, you know, for the long term future. Let me ask you the optimism question. Are you optimistic that things are going to change, that there will be improvement in terms of equity in with mainstream organizations?
I'm more optimistic with individuals and grassroots organizations, the people, right? Like I have strong hopes and I am very optimistic when it comes to people-led
centered organizations and movements, but in terms of longstanding, you've been around for 100 years, and you sent out a statement last year that you, you know, tend to lean more now towards diversity and inclusion. I don't have that built confidence because I haven't seen results. I've seen reactions, right? I've seen the statement, but the actual groundwork to make those statements live and sustainable and actually change community, I haven't seen that consistently yet. It's too soon to tell. And I don't want to speak on what I do not know. But I do know that there are some people on the ground that are doing work, and those people, I'm hopeful in them.
Yeah, Marlisha, will you say a little bit more, too, about what you were discussing before about how the when we talk about the arts industry, so much of it does lie in the nonprofit sector. And so with an arts nonprofit, can you speak about how, you know, in terms of mission, vision, what that means then to be more focused on the community or community driven versus art for art's sake, if you will?
Okay. All right. So since the nonprofit organizations are grounded in the concept of public contribution, right? Giving for the good, giving for the group, it's all about community. Should not community be placed in the forefront of these conversations? So when we're speaking about equity, are people that are impacted, are they having that voice? And when they do have that voice, is that voice uplifted? Or is it just, oh, fill out a survey and then we'll go back to do business as usual? So that's one component of it. When we think of the framework, right? If there's million-dollar nonprofits, but they're using language that's very paternalistic in nature, instead of requiring community members or even artists to produce content that props up grant writers' wish lists, organizations should be lifting up people, right? So, like, you may have an organization that says, come out here, maybe create some artwork. They use it for a marketing tool or some would say performance work. You may have Black and brown people out there, and so it looks like a diversity effort. But, again, these are Band-Aids because that was one time, one event. That's not changing structure. That's not changing administration. That's just one event. And then that event is posted, of course, on their website, on all the social media links. And so people are coming out thinking that maybe change will happen, but we're just getting content, which, again, will be wrapped up into some grant writers. When I say wish list, of course, they'll get funding off the idea that diversity is happening. And it did happen that one time, but that's not sustainable, right? That's optics. And so if we're going to move past this shallow surface value, I wouldn't even say change. I would say adaptation, things that have been on the move since last year, we really need to look at, again, the system. What part of the system are you in? Are you just a nonprofit? Are you in the nonprofit industrial complex? What part of the nonprofit industrial complex are you perpetuating in the way that you market, in the way that you communicate to people, and the way that you allow artists to feel like there is scarcity. And even in RFPs, how the communication of competitive, right? There's million-dollar organizations that will give out a micro grant for $500 and praise that $500 as if they're looming this $500 like a carrot dangling over artists' heads. Now, let's be real about it. You might have to work 3-4 months for $500. Think about all the other industry outside of the art world. Would anybody else take that as a compliment or an insult? Most places would be like, are you serious? 4 months, 3 months, and I only get $500 and I have to work 20 hours a week? Reduce that down to hourly wage, you're making less than $10 an hour. But there's a lot of organizations that are really excited with these carrots that they dangle out there. And because artists, in many cases, are aware that this is the system, right? They didn't create it, but they live in it, they work in it. They're aware of this. And so when things don't change, you get a lot of artists that are super excited about opportunities that really they should be running from, but instead they run to.
You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett along with WFPL arts reporter Stephanie Wolf. We're talking with Marlisha Woods, who is the owner of L's and O's Storytelling Gallery and works in various other capacities as well, dedicated visual arts educator And also, Brianna Harland is with us, a multi-form artist and organizer. Hey, Brianna, I'm interested in your the New York solo exhibition that you had, Black Love Blooms. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? It's the full title, Black Love Blooms, New York Nook, and to interrupt harmful narratives around Black public image and connection. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
For sure I can, but real quick, I just want to reinforce everything that Marlisha just said, because that was absolutely perfect and right on the nose. And I think oftentimes we hear it and we hear sound bites from it, but people don't really sit with that. So I would encourage everybody to just really, if nothing else that has been said so far, sit with what she just said. So that exhibition, to interrupt harmful narratives around Black public connection and image and representation, it's the same project that I do here and that I did last year here during Juneteenth, Black Love Blooms, which is very simple, just giving out free flowers and love notes and gifts to Black people publicly. And usually by surprise, Juneteenth, it's a little more expected, but it happens all throughout the year. And so I had an exhibition in New York. Nothing was for sale. I have to give kudos to this gallery. They made no money off of my exhibition, and neither did I. And it was basically that Field Projects was the gallery, and it served as a hub for Black Love Blooms to work out of. And so what happens is you're running into the public with these gifts and these and this love, unconditional, labor-free. You don't have to be get any education on movement. You don't have to do anything. You just have to accept some love. And so that does a lot of things. A very simple action does a lot of things. It interrupts the dynamic of the lived experience of the Black person that's receiving. It interrupts the dynamics of the lived experience and internalized information of the other people of color and white people that are seeing this happen about what Blackness is in public. And it also builds community. And so this year, just like last year, several other cities and states are signing on to make this happen in their homes, in their home states, home cities, as a part of Juneteenth celebration. And for me, it's a way for Black people to be able to do something for and in their communities in a way that maybe they would have been intimidated before, you know, if it was some sort of other type of project or something complicated. But they say, I can give out flowers. That's something I can do. And then suddenly more people are involved. So that's what I'm seeing now as people reach out to do it in their cities. And that's exciting.
All right. Thanks so much. We're out of time. I want to thank all of our guests, Brianna Harland, who you just heard, Marlisha Woods, also Andre Kimo Stone, guests, and Liam Sweeney and Andy Trinan and WFPL Stephanie Wolf. Thanks all of you for joining us today. That's all the time we have. You can hear this and other In Conversation programs at WFPL.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to all of our In Conversation production team. I'm Rick Hallett. Thanks for listening.